And today we are speaking with Michael Brent Collings. This is March 2nd, and it is the 8th edition of Farland's Authors Advisory Conference Calls. My name is Robin Weeks. I am the host for this call. Michael Brent Collings is a novelist, a screenwriter, martial artist, and until very recently was a practicing lawyer. We're going to tell you a little bit more about him at the top of the hour, and then he's going to tell us about his 10 steps to overnight success, or how it only took a decade to get. I have heard this presentation already at Life, the Universe, and Everything. It was a great presentation. I asked him to come and do it for us because it's awesome and we need to listen to it. If you have any questions during the course of the presentation tonight, please push 5-star on your phone and we'll be able to listen. We'll be able to let you raise your hand and ask your question. That's even starting right now. If you have any questions, we've got a few more minutes before we start the actual topic. If you have any questions for Michael Brent, then we're going to go ahead and have you push 5-star, and we'll unmute you and let you ask your question. And while they're figuring out where 5-star is, Michael Brent, can you tell
I lost you. Are you still there?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Was that your technical glitch or mine?
You know, every once in a while, I think the tone of your voice somehow trips off. I don't know. Every once in a while, I'll tell you it's an invalid option. Ignore it.
Okay.
That's all I can say. I wish we could figure out what was wrong with that, but
sucks. I'm being told I'm an invalid option by an automated system.
I got that too. So yeah, don't push any buttons, and you know, don't use whatever tone it is that it hates.
I'll talk up here for the rest of the hour.
No, that's the tone I'm using. It's not working for me either. Anyway, can you tell us any news about these movie deal things that you've got going on?
I can tell you that one of them, the main characters, have all been cast, and the secondary characters are going to be cast this week, and production starts next week. And it's going to be a fairly decent-sized production. More millions involved in it than I will probably make in my lifetime, and unless things go really well for me. And other than that, I'm really not allowed to say. They're supposed to be making an announcement in the next couple of weeks, and after that I get to talk about whatever I want to, but until then I'm just out of luck.
These actors, people that we would recognize?
Yes.
Names we know?
Yep. One of them's, you'd recognize the director's work probably, and you'd recognize the main actor, but I actually talked to the production company today. This is why I know about it, because we had a chat today, and they told me, and then they said, but do not tell anybody. So they're probably monitoring right now, in which case I think you guys are awesome.
Yes, and we are recording this and plan to be posting it later. So let's not say anything we oughtn't.
No.
That might
no.
be embarrassing.
I love all of those guys. They're great.
I'm sure. They're wonderful.
They actually are.
Can you tell us which film studio is doing it?
No, I'm not even allowed to say that. They wrote into my contract. I'm not allowed to talk about it at all. So I got kind of informal okay to let people know that casting is going on. But beyond that, I'm supposed to clam up and play dumb, which is not hard for a writer in Hollywood. So.
Or a lawyer, by that.
Yeah, exactly. I can barely answer questions anyways.
Pretty cool. I have been reading The Meridians. I'm not quite done yet. It's very frustrating that I have to take time out to do this phone call. but I noticed that I told you this on the email, that your writing style is very much like Dean Koontz. Was that intentional? Is he one of your the people that you grew up on? I mean, where'd you get your writing style from, my
well,
friend?
My dad is a retired English professor, and for about 10 years he was the world expert, and I'm saying that literally, like there was nobody who knew more about Stephen King in the world than my dad, except maybe Stephen King. And
maybe
there was some stuff that I'm pretty sure Stephen King probably read about, and he's like, I don't remember that, but So my dad was very involved in horror, and he loved Stephen King. I read a lot of that growing up. He loved Dean Koontz, and so I also read a ton of that. I also got to meet Dean Koontz, you know, a couple years after my dad started interacting with him, and he is just a super neat human being. He's just one of the nicest people I've met in my little romp through professional writing, and so it's not a purposeful thing. I'm not sitting down and going, what would Dean Koontz do? But definitely he's one of my formative people. I read a lot of Dean Koontz. I read a lot of Stephen King. I read a lot of Orson Scott Card. And I think you see bits and pieces of all of them coming out in my writing because that was my formative experience. You know, my dad, it got to a point where I was young and my father would say, okay, you can't read anymore. And by the way, I'm talking like I'm 11 years old and reading these guys because I started reading early and I started reading a lot. And my dad would literally say, okay, you can't read any more of these guys until you've read all of Dickens or all of Shakespeare. So I got my classical education as a means of getting to the good stuff.
Bribery is a great parenting technique.
Oh,
I'm sure you're using it.
It totally worked. It worked on me, you know, and it was just, this is the rule. You got to read this row of Shakespeare books, and then you can read, you know, you can read Carrie after that. But until you've read The Tempest, you're not allowed to go to Firestarter. And it worked really well. I got a really nice, well-rounded literary education that way, and I also got to read grips of stuff that I really enjoyed.
Very cool. Well, we are about at the top of the hour, and looks like nobody has any pre-call questions. So let's go ahead and start the actual call, and maybe we'll have some questions as we go along. If you are just joining us, it is now the top of the hour, different time zones everywhere, but we are in the 8th edition of Farland's Authors Advisory Conference Calls. This is a free call sponsored by David Farland's Writers Group. That's at www.farlandswritersgroups.com. It's a writers group forum for aspiring writers. We also have some more experienced writers. We've got some debut writers that are just publishing their first soft, their first novels coming up this year. My name is Robin Weeks. I'm your host for the call tonight. It's March 2nd, 2011. Joining us is Michael Brent Collings. And he is a novelist, a screenwriter, martial artist. Until recently, he was a practicing lawyer. He quit that when being a writer started to pay better, which is living the dream, Michael Brent, living the dream. He has written numerous novels, including Run, Billy, Messenger of Powers, The Loon, Rising Fears, and The Meridians, which I am enjoying right now. Michael Brent has also sold, optioned, and done rewrites for screenplays for major Hollywood production companies and is currently developing several movies and television shows. He is not allowed to tell us about any of his film projects right now, but hopefully in a few weeks. Michael Brent, why don't you let us know, and I'll update the blog so everyone can get the news.
I will. I'd love to.
Yay, because I'm going to be very excited to find out.
It'll be posted on Facebook, so you'll know when all of my multitude of fans know.
Excellent. Look forward to that. Tonight's call, if you have a question during the call, dial 5-star to raise your hand on your touch-tone phone. I will notice that your hand is raised, and I will unmute you so that you can ask your question. Tonight's topic is 10 Steps to Overnight Success, or How It Only Took a Decade to Get Paid. Michael Brent, what made you decide to write this kind of presentation?
Well, my mom and dad go to Life, the Universe, and Everything every single year. My dad's been a presenter there, I think, for the last 20-something years. And this year, we kind of all looked at our schedules, and it worked out that I would have some free time right at the same time as LTUE, which is Life, the Universe, and Everything. And so they invited me up, and I figured I might as well be doing something while I was there, so I submitted a paper to the LTUE committee, and they liked it enough to have me present it. So that was the long and short of it. I did it as an excuse to see my mommy and daddy.
That's an excellent excuse. I like it.
I work.
So what made you pick this particular topic for your paper?
You know, it was topical to me. It was something that I was experiencing, and I know being somebody who's been in the middle of working at a difficult job and wishing I could write more, it's something that a lot of writers struggle with, which is just, how long is this going to take? How can I make it? Because it's one of the most frightening things about wanting to be a writer, as people say, and I'm going to talk a little about that later, but one of the most frightening things about wanting to be a writer is just the fact that there's this sort of amorphous future in front of you and you don't know what it holds, and that can be itself intimidating enough to make some people stop writing. And so I wanted to treat that in such a way as to give those folks who are still struggling and climbing up a ray of hope. And by the way, I haven't reached the summit of the mountain myself either. I'm not making millions of dollars and living in Beverly Hills, but I'm a little farther along than some people, and I figured I could kind of, you know, be the guy who's standing a little higher on the hill going, hey, come on up, the view's good, and if you keep working, you can make it here.
I appreciate that. Again, with the dream and living it. Yeah. Your presentation included a lot of what could be considered rather disheartening statistics. You want to just kind of brief us on what those statistics were and what that means for those of us who are trying to climb?
Sure, and they can be disheartening, but I just wanted to present them as kind of a reality check, because I know when I started, I, like everybody else probably, hoped that my first book would hit it big, or that my first screenplay would be bought by Jerry Bruckheimer, or that I'd make my $1 billion immediately. And it was disheartening to find out that that just usually doesn't happen. And so people who know ahead of time what they're getting into are prepared for it better and can face it more easily, I think. So these are actually meant not to scare people away, but just to say, hey, here's what you're in for. It's still a great ride, but you have to be aware of these facts. The top 1% of members of the Writers Guild of America, and the Writers Guild of America is a labor union that to get into, you have to have actually sold some work. So these are people who are already professional authors. Only the top 1% of them make over $600,000. Only the top 25% make $62,000 a year or more. And the average age of the person who actually gets into the guild, meaning they got that sale or optioned enough screenplays to make it, is 35 years old. So this is something that, yes, occasionally you have somebody who writes a best-selling novel at the age of 17, but there's a reason that's called news, and that's because it very rarely happens. Most of the time you're going to be working and slaving for a long time. And if you're getting into it for the money, that might not be a great reason to do it. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median income for salaried writers hovers just over $50,000. Only about the top 10% of salaried writers make more than $95,000. And it has to be emphasized that we're talking about salaried writers here. And that's narrowly defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as people like journalists or professional technical writers. Fiction writers, the people that we're talking to, are mostly freelance writers whose annual take-home, even if they're professionals, meaning they've been paid, is much, much lower than that $50,000. So, again, this isn't meant to scare anybody off, and I hope the listeners haven't just all clicked off en masse and go to hang themselves.
Still here.
It's good to know heading in that this is a job. There's a reason it's called work, and it's because there's some effort you have to put into it. You can overcome these averages. You can be somebody at the top end of these averages. But if you're just going to settle for what's average, this is what you're looking at. And it's a very tough situation to be in if you're just going to settle. You really have to be out pushing yourself.
Okay. What's the best way to go about getting published? From your opinion, what's the best way to do it?
Well, I mean, if you want to get published, there's a multitude of ways, and each of them have sort of pluses and minuses. If you're going to make huge amounts of money, the chances to do that go up greatly if you're being published by a large house like Scholastic or Bantam. But that itself has an inherent earnings inhibitor built in, because most of those large publishing houses require that you submit exclusively to them. So you can't submit to all 30 of the big houses, or however many there are. You've got to do it one at a time. And each time they look at your work, it's going to take between a couple of months and a year and a half for them to look at it and get back to you with a positive or a negative. And even if it's a positive, that is, yes, we want to publish it, it's great, the wind-up time to actually get your book to press can take another year and a half. So you're looking at anywhere from 1.5 to 3 years, best-case scenario, to get your book published. Now, if you go to a smaller press, and you can get those names by looking at the writer's market or any of a number of online resources, you can get names of small publishers. If you go to them, the turnaround's much quicker. They have a lot of them don't require you to submit exclusively, but at the same time, the problem with them is they're smaller houses. They're more limited, so the chances of you being a huge blockbuster success are much smaller simply because they don't have the PR to compete with Scholastic or Bantam. And then there's another route that's become sort of a burgeoning industry in the last couple of years with the advent of the Kindle and its incredible popularity, which is you can try and self-publish and make your money selling ebooks online at Amazon. And that it has some great things to it, because if you want to publish it, you can. There's no gatekeeper. You just have to have a book. You can decide to do it all on your own and just do it. The downside is the chances of thousands and thousands and thousands of people picking up your work and looking at it from over 800,000 other options is very slim, and you have to have something really special to be able to push yourself to the front in that kind of a group. So they're all valid ways of going about it. All of them have pluses. All of them have minuses. It depends on the individual writer and his predilections, I would say.
Now, you are going the self-publishing ebook route. Is that right?
Well, I have one book that's been published by a small press, and I have a whole bunch of books that have been published by small presses, actually. And then, yes, a lot of my work is being published by ebooks. I'm a real exception that's proved the rule. My ebook run is in the top 10 of the horror and science fiction novels. The top 10 best-selling novels in those genres on Amazon.com, and it's in the best-selling top 100 for thrillers, I think. So it's doing really well, but again, if you look at those lists, the funny thing about a top 100 list is there's only room for 100 books on it. It's real hard to get there.
Yeah, yeah. You've been able to make, I imagine that the screenplay and that sort of income is also factoring into your ability to quit your job, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I'm not making peanuts. I'm making some decent money with the e-books, but it's definitely the added cushion of a pretty decent paycheck that's allowed me to kind of sit back and go, all right, I'm going to toggle my fingers for a while and see what happens.
All right. Well, let's go on to the 10 steps.
Okay.
And you've got 10 steps of how to basically get to where you are and perhaps even beyond eventually. What's the first one?
Well, the first one, this is going to sound obvious, but it's not. The first step is you've got to write. If you want to make a living as a writer, you have to write. You have to write all the time. You write your books, your screenplays, your stories, and when you're done writing those and you're too tired to write anymore, write about them. So start a blog and issue press releases and have a Facebook page, because your writing muscle is like any other muscle in the body. It atrophies when it's not used, and unlike a lot of muscles, it atrophies immediately. I mean, there have been times where I've looked at myself and said, I'm going to take a break because I just finished a novel or I just finished a screenplay. And for me, a break is 3, 4, 5 days. And man, it is hard to start up again when I take a complete break from writing. It is tremendously difficult to get that momentum going. So the best way to be a writer is to write. Now, I recognize that not everybody has the time or the ability in their day-to-day needs to write for 7-8 hours, and that's fine too, but what you have to do is write consistently. Set aside a certain amount of time every day or every week or even every month or every year. If it's the 16th of December once a year and you're going to write for an hour, great, do it, but make sure you do it every single year, because if you don't, you're going to start to let other life things crowd out your writing, and it is impossible, as hard as it is to make it as a writer, it is impossible to make it as a writer if you're not writing.
Well, that seems to make sense. So what would be the next step?
The next thing is what we're doing here, which is involving yourself in marketing. The sad fact is, in today's world, the way we are structured, which we're a very entertainment-centric organism anymore. I mean, we all look to news for infotainment. We all spend a lot of time watching TV, and this kind of overlaps into our social circles and into our business circles. If given the choice between somebody who's a tiny blotch on a chair and somebody who's out there selling themselves, companies that are going to want to put money into you will go with the guy who's selling himself. So you have to be involved in your marketing. You have to get involved in writers' forums, enter contests, and be a voice that is heard. So when people think, oh, who are the writers we know? Immediately they go, oh, Michael Brent Collings, he's really cool. I heard him on David Farland's Authors Network the other day. So you can do interviews, and you can do interviews on blogs like this. There's, look them up. You can Google them and find different places. They're always looking for writers. You can do blog interviews on websites. The Author Exchange blog and Two Ends of the Pen are to name just a few. There's tons of them. But
when would you suggest us starting all of this? Should we wait until we have, you know, a publishing contract?
No, goodness no. I mean, if you're writing, you're a writer. And so if you look at yourself and you recognize that you are truly a novice in every aspect, and that's not a bad thing because that means you're green and green things grow. That's a great place to be. But if you're truly novice in every aspect, then you're probably not going to be posting a whole lot of interviews. But most people have moved beyond true novicehood, and they have at least one or two areas where they go, hey, you know what? I'm decent at character development. Or even, you know what? I'm writing right now. Michael Brent said on that cool David Farland show, Michael Brent said marketing is important. And for my day job, I'm a salesperson. I know plenty about marketing. So you can immediately start jumping on and applying your real life experience as a writer. And people will want to hear that. So you can contact some of these blogs and say, hey, I'm a salesperson by day, and I'm working on my first novel, and I have some great sales tip I would love to give to writers. And you'd be surprised how many people will go, bring it on, because one of the great things about the internet is there is a huge gaping maw of hunger for content, and people are constantly looking for stuff to fill up the airwaves, only it's the internet waves. So just because you haven't published something is no reason you shouldn't become something of an authority. You can always do that, always.
Very cool. For me, I like to interview people, and so I get to do that.
Yeah. I mean, everybody knows your name by then, you know, it's Robin. Everybody knows you because you're doing this. And, you know, you're not at the top of a bestseller list yet, but this is certainly a way to establish yourself, and anybody can do that.
Cool. Very cool. And by the way, if anyone has any questions, another reminder, push 5-star on your Touchstone phone. Feel free to push it anytime. Then when we reach a good break, we'll let you ask your question.
Oh, and
so,
no one wants for an hour.
Well, two lawyers talking is always entertaining. What are you talking about?
Oh, my gosh. It's like dry ice. It's terrible.
What do you mean? Lawyers are nice.
We are. We're good people.
So the third one. What's the third thing you have to do?
Okay, the next thing goes right along with number two. Number two is get involved in marketing. Number three is plug your work. It does no good to be a highly visible personality and everybody knows about you and you're on the web and you're on the screen and you're on radio and you're on blogosphere. And every time you show up, you kind of smile and you rub your toe on the ground a little and you say, oh, 'twarn't nothing. And you never mention anything you've done. The whole point of arranging for these interviews is so that you can showcase yourself and your work. So, for instance, I've got this book. You'll notice earlier on we were talking about publishing, and I mentioned Run, which is a book that's doing really well. Robin, I really appreciate you mentioning The Meridians, which is the latest work.
Very, very fun, by the way.
Thank you. Your check's in the mail.
Thank you.
The point of doing these is to get your stuff out there. So you've got to find – you don't want to be talking about it constantly. If I just came on and every question you ask, I go, well, that reminds me of something in Run, or that reminds me of when I was writing The Meridians and waiting for my inevitable award, that would be really obnoxious. But everybody – who's asking you questions as a writer is interested in your writing. So have a little self-esteem and talk about those things. I mean, in almost every successful career that I'm aware of is populated by a person who has a certain amount of moxie. And I'm not talking about going up and stalking people. I'm talking about just a willingness to accept the fact that you have some valuable contributions. So don't be afraid to say, hey, that reminds me of my book. But along with that, it's very helpful and this is a little marketing tip, it's very helpful to have a fast way of explaining the book or the screenplay or the poem or whatever it is, because nobody wants to sit down and be tied to 45 minutes of explanation about how great your book is. If they say, what's it about, you should have something fast to be able to tell them, so that in 1, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10 sentences, they've got a decent idea, oh, this is something you might be interested in. Again, not to talk about me so much, but I'm familiar with my stuff. The tagline for Run, all that there is on Amazon is just two lines that says, what would you do if everyone you knew, family, friends, everyone, wanted to kill you? Answer, you run. And that's it. And if people ask what it's about, that's what I tell them. And it's fast and it's kind of interesting. And they go, oh, neat. And I'm not being obnoxious about it, because I'm not going to say, well, the story opens in and give them the whole plot summary. They don't want me to be a Cliff's Notes. They want me to entice and interest them.
Yeah. How do you have any, because for me, writing that itty-bitty tiny snippet of my really, really long book is one of the hardest things. Do you have any tips for us on how to craft that sort of thing?
You know, the best tip that I have found for doing it is to start with that. If I am writing a really long and involved book and then I come back through the back door and I try and turn it into two sentences, it's so difficult. And part of the reason is just psychologically I'm so invested in it. It's like, well, I wrote a 400-page book. Every single sentence, every jot and tittle is crucial. How can I strip out all of it and give them three sentences? And it makes it really hard just on a psychological level to do that. Whereas if when you're beginning your thought process, you go, this is a book about this, it makes it a lot easier. The Meridians, I knew, was going to be about a woman and her autistic son who are on the run from a supernatural killer. Not a ghost. I knew it wasn't a ghost. Not to spoil it for you, Robin, but it's not a ghost.
I figured that out.
But some kind of killer who has more than the average range of talents. And so having decided that, it makes it a heck of a lot easier to describe it that way from then on. And I don't have to worry about killing myself to come up with two sentences, because that is tremendously difficult. It is so hard.
Yeah. Looks like we do have a question. Let's
cool.
take it from a phone number ending 1249. Tell us your name and then tell us your question. And maybe I didn't actually push the. There we go.
Oh, hi. Hi, my name's Robert Skelton, and I got involved in all of this when I met David Farland at a book signing with Brandon Sanderson not too long ago.
Cool.
Corinth in California. And after a series of emails, I got interested in this whole thing. So anyway, pursuant to step number three, you mentioned how to plug and basically having a short way of summarizing your work.
Mm-hmm.
It occurred to me that an exercise that my old English teacher, she was a holy terror, by the way.
So she did her job then.
Yes, she did her job. One time the class, not me, I was a very well-behaved high school student by that time. The class got her really mad, ticked her off, and so she wrote an approximately 250-word sentence.
Oh, my gosh.
It was all punctuation, and she said, okay, you get to write that 100 times. So,
wow.
I learned punctuation really good.
I bet.
But anyway, one of the exercises that she had us run was that she had us do paragraph summaries.
Mm.
In other words, a collection of sentences or whatever, and she would have us summarize that paragraph in one or two brief sentences.
That is a really helpful exercise, not just in creating your synopsis, but in writing generally, because ultimately, a lot of the time, I bet you would have found that those two sentences you crafted were more effective actual prose than the paragraph they were based off of.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things my father was my best teacher, and one of the things he always said that I loved was, when you're writing, imagine each word costs you $1,000. And boy, you would be surprised how fast that made my prose a lot more crisp and clear, because I was focusing on the cost to the reader and to myself of writing all this excess verbiage. That's a great exercise. If you can take some of the classics, I mean, this is where you can actually stand up and put yourself in Shakespeare's shoes, or you know, look at any of the great authors through time, Dickens, or even our modern masters, again, Dean Koontz or Stephen King. Take a paragraph out of their book and see if you can make it better. That's a wonderful tip. That really is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
You're welcome.
Let's move on to the fourth tip. What's the next thing?
Well, the next thing that you have to do is make connections. If they say it's not what you know, it's who you know, and that's just a load, because no matter who you know, if you're an idiot and you can't put two sentences together and make them coherent, you're not going to do too well as a writer. You have to know your craft. You have to put stuff together in a way that people respond to. But once you've done that, it's tremendously helpful to know people. A story I like to tell, one of the screenplays that we were talking about at the top of the hour that I can't talk about much is called Barricade. And it did really well in a competition called the Nichols, which is one of the premier screenwriting competitions in the world. And as a result, it made its way around Hollywood, and everybody loved it, and everybody was a fan. Oh, and by the way, if you're in Hollywood and somebody says, I'm a big fan, that means I liked your work, but I don't want to pay you. Just word to the wise. So one of these fans was a junior executive at a production company. And I'm going to call him Johnny because that's an easy name to remember. So Johnny loved Barricade. He was a big fan, which meant I'm not going to pay you right now, but he wanted to meet me. And I met him, and I met everybody else at the production company. And every time I met somebody, I would make sure to get a business card, and then I would either write them a letter, an actual old-fashioned letter, or email them within a day or two of meeting them just to let them know it was a pleasure meeting them. And if I could ever do anything for them, I was happy to chat. And literally 5 years went by. And out of the blue, Johnny calls up. And Barricade had not been purchased by his production company originally because they just weren't interested in that kind of a story. But in the intervening years, the production company had undergone a management change and a paradigm shift, and they had, you know, done all those buzzwords that companies do when they're reorganizing themselves. And so Johnny emailed and said, hey, we're looking for a ghost story, and we want to talk to you about Barricade. Now, the fact of the matter is, he liked Barricade in the beginning, but in the intervening years, every 6-8 months, I had dropped him an email saying, hey, how you doing? I kept an eye out for Johnny's name in the trade magazines, you know, in Variety and Hollywood Reporter, and anytime his company did something, I'd just send a quick note. I was not a stalker. You don't want to be desperate. It's a lot like dating. If you're desperate, they run away. Or if you look like me, they run away. But either way, I have a face made for radio. That's why I'm doing this. But the fact is, as much as he liked Barricade, I think it had to be combined with the fact that when they walked into his office and said, Johnny, let's do a ghost story, he was able to think of me because I wasn't some person that he'd met 5 years before and never had another interaction with. I was somebody that we had spoken recently. We had spoken within the last couple of months. So he went, oh, my gosh, there's Michael Brent. He just emailed me. Where's his script? It's somewhere in this office. And he could immediately grab it and hand it to them. So the strength and the importance of these connections you make is critical. Go to author signings. Don't be a crazy person, but say hello. If they're interested in giving you their contact information, send them a short email. Hey, you rock. You're great. And keep up with these people. Don't do something crazy. Don't end up out in their backyard watching them shower at night or something. But you can be friendly and be a friend and be available, and that matters to people.
Mike just said, or pester them via email. You probably don't want to do that.
Well, don't pester them, but, you know, like I said, Johnny from this production company, every 6 months I just drop him an email that just said, hey, hope you're doing well, period. That's it. I mean, and that's all it takes. And I was sincere. He was a nice guy. I really like him, and you don't want to be insincere and phony, but, hey, if you connect with somebody, there's no reason you shouldn't keep up with them. At LTUE, I met a trio of really cool guys and immediately got all of their contact information. And the day after I got off the plane coming home, I emailed those guys just to say, hey, it was awesome meeting you. I mean, I met more than three guys that were great, but there was three in particular that I really kind of connected with. And I know I'm going to keep up with these guys because they're cool. And all I got to do is every couple months go, hey, how's it going? Hope you're well, period. sign off. And people appreciate that kind of communication. People, we live in an age that is so full of social interaction at a distance. I think it makes people hunger for people that are genuinely interested in how their lives are going.
Now, along with that, there's a lot of social networking out there right now. Any tips on using that to make connections and maintain them?
Social networking is great. You've got to be really careful, though. Be aware that as a writer, you are a wordsmith, and so you should think very carefully before you put a single thing on Twitter or before you put a single thing on Facebook, for the simple reason that it's going to be there forever. And even unrelated things will come back to haunt you. If you see a friend, if you're driving into your spot at work and somebody has parked there, even though it's clearly your spot, and you Facebook, somebody's took my spot again, I want to take a tire iron to their windows, that's going to reflect poorly on you. So, yes, definitely use all the new social networking. You know, I have a fan page. If you look on Facebook for Michael Brent, I'm the only one in the world. And my username on Twitter is mbcalling, so if you want to follow me, that's great. But I try and only put positive things on there, things that when I'm 100 years old, I can look back and go, that was fine, I'm not ashamed of anything I wrote. You really have to be very careful with what you're writing, because the things that are there, they're written in electrons, but at the same time, they're written in stone. They are never going to go away.
Yeah. I think that kind of relates to the next tip, play nice with others. What's that?
Well, listen, if you're trying to write for yourself, like if you're writing as a form of private psychotherapy, which is great, if you are writing for yourself, you are in the best position in the world because you have an audience that is always going to back you up. You're always going to be there for yourself. But most of us, especially probably listening to this podcast, most of us are trying to write the great American novel or the next blockbuster movie or the next, you know, critically acclaimed poem or whatever it may be. And the reality is that your first draft is probably not going to make it through unscathed and unchanged. The reality is it's going to be pored over by executives whose job is to find out exactly what is wrong with your work in order to have an excuse to turn it down. And this isn't because they're mean, soulless, heartless subhumans. It's because the fact is nothing will get an executive fired faster than backing a major flop. So it's natural that they're going to look through everything like a scientist, through a microscope, to make sure that what they are saying, yes, let's get that. When they say that, it's something as commercially viable as they can make it. So even if it gets past that stage, even if they go, yes, we want to buy your screenplay, yes, we want to buy your novel and give you an advance on it, yes, we want to publish your short story, you are probably going to be given something called notes. And this means that you're going to have to change stuff, okay? This doesn't mean that you're going to relinquish all of your control. I always like to talk about story meetings in Hollywood because they can be tremendously humorous from an outside sort of standpoint. You can go into a story meeting, and most of my screenplays are like my books. They tend to be thrillers. They tend to be about scary things happening to people. And you can go into a screenplay and say, and hear something like, we really liked your screenplay. We're really excited to be making this movie. The only problem is the ghost should be less scary, like Casper. Or maybe let's make it a dog. In fact, the story should actually be about Lassie, but Lassie should maybe be a leprechaun who grants wishes to orphans. And why aren't there any orphans in this thing anyways? Or dragons, because everybody knows the dragons sell, or maybe not. I'm not sure. But for sure, the main character should have a scar on his forehead, but not a lightning bolt, because that's too on the nose. And so all of a sudden, you have this thing that you've worked and struggled and toiled and sweated over for years maybe, and all of a sudden it's being eviscerated by people who just walked into it 10 minutes ago. And this is the reality, and you're going to have to learn to deal with it. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Writing for today's market is a collaborative study and a collaborative process. It's collaborative because it's first of all between you and your readers. But it's also collaborative just to get it to the readers, because there are these intervening gatekeepers that you're going to have to satisfy. And so when they give you your notes, you don't want to react poorly. You don't want to throw your pen down and say, it's perfect as it is, and then storm off in a huff. You've got to learn to take these ideas, these contributions. I have a couple of ways that I like to deal with these. first of all, no matter who is giving the advice, no matter what they're saying or how crazy it may seem, I thank them for their thoughts, because the fact of the matter is, it's a real person that I'm talking to. They took the time to look through my work. They have some kind of a response to it, and I should be grateful. I've got a reader, and so I'm going to treat them like gold. They are my client and the customer is always right. So in a majority of the circumstances, the ideas will be helpful ones. Even if they're not overtly helpful, they might contain a kernel of truth that will end up improving the story. A silly example, if the story executive thinks that your fantasy magicians should be more like dogs, it may be because the rules of the fantasy haven't been clearly set forth and the executive is confused or the editor is confused. And this means you've got to go and clarify things. So even though the person is saying, hey, can't we have dogs instead of mages? What they're really saying is, I don't get your mages, and you can go and clean that up, and you should be grateful that someone pointed that out to you. Every once in a while, you get a concern that's really, really off the mark. I like to use the example of pink socks because very few people wear them, and there's no organized union that I'm aware of protecting the rights of pink socks wearers, so they're easy to pick on. But if the guy says, look, your main character had pink socks on, and I hate pink socks, and they're evil, and I want it gone, well, you got two things that you want to think about. First of all, are the pink socks really critical to your story? And if they're not, get rid of them. Make the guy happy. He's a gatekeeper. You want to get it to the next level. And if the pink socks are critical to your story, you want to thank the guy for his input. Again, always thank the person. And incidentally, I'm using he and guy as meaning he, she, and guy, gal. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to do it for time purposes and to conserve energy, so I apologize. I'm not sexist. I'm just trying to be shorthandy. But anyways, you thank this person for giving you their input, and you look at them and say, look, I think I see where you're going with the pink socks idea, and if that's the way we all decide to go, I can work with that because I'm a writer and I can do anything. I'm a world creator. But if I take out the pink socks, I worry it might change the novel or the screenplay or the story or the haiku or whatever it is. It might change it into something different that loses the qualities that we loved enough to get together in this room to talk about. And very often when you say it that way, you first acknowledge the validity of what the person is saying, and second, you have given them kudos in front of their peers, in front of their bosses, and as a result, third, you've probably made a friend. And very often that defuses the issue right there. And even if it doesn't, again, what's going to happen is it throws the question back on the person giving the note so that they have to come up with a justification for that note. And often that's where you get the real information. And he'll say, well, look, to be honest, a lot of people are killed every year by people wearing pink socks. So we should really think about changing that because there's a genuine hatred of them in the United States or Canada or Europe or wherever you're selling your book. And again, that's information that wouldn't have come out if you had just said, oh, the pink socks are necessary. What are you, mad? And stormed off. So you really have to learn how to, it's a big sandbox. You've got to learn how to play nice with all the other kids.
Pink socks are always necessary.
Hey, I've got a couple pairs myself. I'm a big fan. But, you know, like I say, not a lot of protections out there for him, so I can pick on him okay with some measure of impunity. But apologies to any listeners who are wearing them. I do like them, and I have some myself.
Sure you're not a killer.
No.
Well, your next one, constantly improve but don't overstudy. Tip number 6, what's that?
Okay, this is one of the coolest things about writing is you can do it anywhere. If you give me a stick of charcoal and a wall, I can write something. And it's something that you can do for your whole life. If you're doing hockey or ultimate fighting or water polo, you've got a certain shelf life, and once you hit it, you're done, man. But writing, you can do better and better and better and better and better until the day you die face down on a keyboard. So this is a great thing. You can constantly improve. No matter how accomplished, no matter how many publications you have under your belt, you can always learn something new. But there's a trap there because the learning should never take the place of the doing. And to illustrate that, I have a story. I was one of my jobs involved training large groups of people. And the training seminars tended to be long, boring, dry affairs. And so when I was put into this training position, I thought, I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to make it fun. I'm going to make it a circus, and it's going to be, you know, people are going to be laughing and people are going to be crying, and it'll be the best training seminar anyone's ever heard in their lives. And so I did it that way, and it was a huge success, and everybody loved it. And then my boss comes up to me, and he was livid. And I was shocked because I had done this, you know, great world-shattering job, and I thought they were probably going to change the whole face of the organization and rename it after me because of this job I did. And he looks at me and says, did it ever occur to you that we have boring meetings for a reason? Did it ever occur to you that we want people to have more fun working than training? And that really struck me, and it has a very strong correlation to writing. I think there's room for fun in almost everything, but a lot of writers, I've noted, they start off really hot. They're the next big thing in fantasy or science fiction or horror, and a book or two hits the bestseller list, and all of a sudden, something happens. They start being speakers. They start lecturing on how to write. They start writing books on how to write, and then they forget to keep writing. Or at best, writing becomes like their second form of amusement instead of their primary form of expression. So as writers, we have to always, always improve ourselves, but we don't want to be sucked into a trap that I call constant improvement with minimal accomplishment. If you want to read a book on characterization, great, do that. But then immediately run out and sit down at your computer and write a book where the secondary goal, because your first goal is always to tell a killer story, your secondary goal is to put all that you've learned into effect and write the best characters you've ever written. You don't want to miss the forest for the trees, and you don't want to miss writing for the smug satisfaction that comes along with just learning something. You don't want to become an aged master who walks along looking at the students' folded arms because they're so afraid to actually get down and do what they're teaching for fear that they might fail, that they have become unqualified to practice the very art they're teaching. You want to always be doing it. You want to always be writing. Don't just improve. Get out there and practice what you've learned.
How can... You know, as we're going along, I think most people who are learning, you know, dream of the day that, you know, maybe somebody will come to me and want me to teach about what I'm learning now. How do we balance it? Any tips on that?
Yeah, like I say, just whenever, look, if you're teaching about something that you've learned, that's great. I mean, that's essentially what I'm doing right now, right, is giving some hints about some things that I've learned in the hopes that it will make somebody else's life a little easier than mine was. I mean, it was 15 years between my first, well, it was almost 20 years between my first sale of a short story to a local newspaper and Run hitting the bestseller lists or releasing the Meridians. So it was this huge gap, and I'd like other people to be able to avoid that gap if possible. So I'm teaching. But guess what I did for the rest of my day?
I was writing?
Yeah, I was sitting in Barnes & Noble's with a hot chocolate rapidly cooling on me as I pounded away at my keyboard. So the trick isn't balance. I think balance is a myth that we have bought into in our culture, as though if you have proper balance, you can walk a tightrope and have a billion pounds of weight on you as long as it's balanced properly. Well, that's stupid. The tightrope's going to snap. What you have to do is prioritize what you're going to hold on to first. And so if you want to be a writer, then make darn sure that what you are doing first and foremost is writing. If you've got a real day job that you have to do, great. Do your day job and then get home and write. If you want to be a teacher, by all means, teach. But that's different than wanting to be a writer who teaches occasionally. And you never want to mix those two up.
Okay, well, let's move on to your seventh tip.
Okay, this is the easiest sounding and possibly the most difficult to actually accomplish. Tip number seven is to be clear. This is something that's really difficult, especially if you're talking about genre pieces, fantasy and science fiction and horror, supernatural, occult. People read fiction to be transported to another place to give them some experience that they wouldn't have otherwise. And that is a key thing to recognize, is that reading is experiential. And so writing has to be the proffering of experiences. So the first thing that a reader of a work of fiction has to do is suspend disbelief. They have to put away the reality of what's true in order to immerse themselves in the reality of the story. And this is why some details can sink or save a book, because if too many things don't ring true, then the reader's ability to suspend disbelief is undermined, and the reader stops being an active participant in this experience of the book's adventures or the screen or the movie's goings on, and instead they turn into a critic. We've all been in a movie theater where somebody sits in the back and just picks the movie to pieces. That person is turned into a scientist who's looking for what's wrong rather than enjoying what's right. And that's our fault as the creators of these worlds. We want them to be so interesting and so enjoyable and so captivating that people forget to look behind the curtain. But the idea of suspension of disbelief is even more important when you're writing genre works, because in addition to the first layer of suspension, which is the fact that the reader is not really participating in the fictional adventures of the book, there's another layer of disbelief that has to be dealt with, which is the question of magic, of alien technologies, of ghosts, of specters. These make-believe aspects of genre writing create a real problem because they inherently inhibit the reader's ability to put aside the real world in favor of the read world. So the best way to deal with this problem is through the critical characteristic of clarity. The best genre work always takes place in a fully realized world with clear, easily understood, or at least fairly easily understood rules. A great example of this that everybody knows about is the blockbuster, The Sixth Sense. It's one of the top grossing suspense thriller movies of all time. Now, the rules are set up very early on in the movie. The kid can see ghosts. The ghosts don't know they're dead. He can help them move on by finding out what unfinished business it is that they're remaining to deal with. And these simple rules set the scene for an engaging ghost story and one of the greatest surprise endings that anyone's ever seen. I mean, I can still remember watching The Sixth Sense and my jaw hitting the sticky floor that was covered in, you know, drinks and popcorn, because I was so amazed, and so many people had that experience, and it was totally built on the fact that they had set up the rules early, and then they sideswiped us by showing how they applied in an interesting way. But the rules were always there, and they were very, very clear. If you want to go for a literary example, look at The Lord of the Rings. Tolkien draws on a much wider palette to paint sort of an epic portrait of this entire world at war. So it's not an intimate, claustrophobic experience like The Sixth Sense. It's this huge thing that follows dozens of characters through huge landscapes through Middle Earth. And the magic is prolific, it's varied, but there are still rules, and Tolkien sticks to them. Each character has a genetic marker. Elves, they naturally incline toward nature. Dwarves prefer to be underground. They want to be underground. Gandalf the Grey, totally different guy than Gandalf the White. So each one has set characteristics, set attributes, and set rules that are very clearly defined. You have to have a clear understanding of what is occurring, of where it's going, and of how it relates to your story. And if you, this goes back to our discussion earlier about creating like a two or three sentence description of what you're writing about or what your book is about. If you have a sense of clarity about what you're doing, that will be much easier to achieve. Very often, the fact that you can't come up with, or that I can't come up with, I should say, the fact that I can't come up with a clear, short description of my work means that it's not clearly described in the work.
Wow. We've got a question, again, from Robert Skelton.
Cool.
Robert?
Amen.
Are you there, Robert?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, no, I was just going, Michael Brandt was explaining this, it popped into my head. I'm a great admirer of Mark Twain, and I've seen this happen in, as I've been exploring, looking at my stories, because I used to write a lot in high school, just to amuse myself, because sometimes classes were so dull. But I find myself looking at them and going, wow, he always said something, he used to say something like this, that the truth is obligated, or that fiction is obligated to stick to the probabilities, but the truth isn't.
Yeah.
In other words, in order to be a successful fiction writer, I believe that you have to have that, what you were saying was that sense of clarity, but that you have to make it seem plausible.
Yeah, well, certainly that goes to the suspension of belief, of disbelief. You can't just say, okay, my rule is that cows fly everywhere and not have an explanation for that, because that's going to jar the modern sensibility. But that, the fact that you know that cows fly in your book is at least a rule, and you can explain it. Okay, they're magic cows that are milked by pixies every morning. That's fine, but it gives you a starting point to solidly ground in specific rules your reality, whatever it is. I mean, honestly, I love Dean Koontz. Now, the chances of my being chased after by a serial killer who's trying to steal my heart because it came from his sister or something like that is pretty darn slim. But he sets up these rules so well and makes it so real through the use of his clear, crisp writing that I'm immediately immersed in it, and I forget that this will never happen, and my pulse starts to pound.
Yes, I've encountered that a lot. It's great that you mentioned Tolkien. Just to give that quote a little context, Twain knew Nikolai Tesla, the scientist, personally.
Poor Mr. Tesla, who got ripped off by certain other people.
Yes, yes. But it was just amazing, because I looked it up on the Wikipedia and saw photos of Twain in Tesla's lab, and I'm like, oh my goodness, he would know this firsthand. That, in other words, that our truth or reality is so strange sometimes that we would just go, it would be a brain popping experience to experience it. I'm trying to say, I'm probably fumbling it.
Well, you know, that's an interesting discussion in itself, which is the reality of our world versus the reality of fiction, the truths that we seek to espouse through our fiction, which are applicable across the board in all realities, and the different ways that you approach each of those realities to make them palatable to people. Nikola Tesla came up with what's generally understood as a far superior light bulb and a far superior electrical process to the one that Albert Edison did. But Edison was a master of PR, and in effect, he was able to lay down his rules of reality so clearly and such an interesting fashion that they drove Tesla bankrupt. He was not able to keep up with it. That's a really interesting example as far as fiction writing goes. You want to be Edison. You want to be somebody that, even though your reality isn't perhaps as real as the reality we live in, you are so good at explaining it that people would prefer to live with you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Robert, for your question. We've actually got a couple other questions.
Great.
Dave Smith?
Hi, I have a real simple question, but I just also wanted to say how much I appreciate all of what you've been saying, and it really, you're right on the money on so much of it. Just to preface, I'm an author. I write romance, so
cool.
Everything you're saying is, yeah. I'm one of those that is not very good at PR and staying in touch. I'm a real hermit personality, and I'm discovering that doesn't work well. When you make these contacts and after 6 months you hit up people and that sort of thing, do you keep a log to remind yourself?
You know what? What I used to do was every time I got a business card, I would staple it to this piece of paper and I put it in a book. And on the back of the business card I'd write, you know, it's Johnny, he has a funny nose, and that would remind me who Johnny was. And that worked okay, but what's far better I find is a combination of technology and caring. Technology, I just go to Yahoo and I have every 6 months a little thing pops up in my email that says, contact Johnny. And rather than writing who Johnny is on the back of his business cards, when I meet him, I take the time to actually give a care about him. I take a little bit of time to memorize his face, to think about what he's like, to notice the things he enjoys, to talk about him a little bit. And that way, when it comes up and my email says, contact Johnny, I can, instead of going, who the heck is Johnny, which is not a great place to start a relationship from, I go, oh, Johnny, he is so funny. I love him. And it makes it a lot easier to make those connections, because people can tell if you're full of hot air. They can tell if you're just doing this because it'll help you. And if you can cultivate a real genuine appreciation of humanity, I think it will help you with your career.
That's what I prefer to do. and I mean, because I don't do the BS real well. So I make a few really good friends. But, you know, when you're in the business, you need to have contacts. And I'd like to have more contacts on a sincere level. So
you know, I'm going to tell you a story, something that I did with some friends once that was a real eye-opener. It's a silly story, but it has a point. I was at a wedding, and we all know that weddings are these excruciating affairs. I mean, they're wonderful and life-affirming and all that stuff, but they suck too, because you basically, especially if you don't know anybody, you get in a receiving line, and if you're a part of the wedding party, especially, you sit there in the receiving line and people march by and you have no idea who they are. You are never going to talk to them again, and it's just 3 hours of going, hey, how are you? Hey, how are you? Hey, how are you? No, I'm with the bride. No, I'm with the bride. No, I'm with the bride. And what I was at a wedding with several of my friends. We were all in the line of groomsmen, and we made a bet with each other that we could find something interesting about every single person who came down the line. And it was a terrific, fun evening, because instead of, hey, how are you? Hey, how are you? It was, hey, I love that dress. Oh, my gosh, where did you buy those earrings? You have sparkly eyes. And it really opened my eyes to the fact that if you want to take the time and try and do it, you can find something interesting and memorable and fun about just about anybody.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you for your question.
That was a good question, Dave. Thanks. We've got one more question, then we really do need to move on. We've got four more things to talk about and 6 minutes to do it in. Liz, Mark O'Brien, are you okay to go over a bit?
I am here until you guys are sick of me.
All right. Very cool. Gina Richards has another question. Regina, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Regina.
Hi, Regina.
Michael Brent, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
a little nervous. I'm going to give my question, and then I'll take my answer off in mute. Could you, at some point, and I don't know if it'll be after you've done the rest of the list or at the end, could you talk a little bit about working on multiple projects at once, if you do that, and
sure.
How do you juggle the time investment in each project and juggle the transition from working on one piece to another piece, particularly if they're in different genres?
Okay. The answer to how I juggle it is I go by my wallet, and that sounds crass, but my first and foremost and most important thing that I'm doing as a writer is trying to take care of my family. And so if I have a project that's going to pay me versus one that I'm doing on spec as a speculative project, I will do the one that's paying me first, no matter how drab or boring it is. If I've got two projects that are paying me, I will focus first on the one with the biggest and fastest paycheck. And again, I don't mean to sound rude about it, but just the reality is my most important possession is my family, and I never want to lose them, and so I want to take care of them, and that means I'm going to work on the things that are going to pay me. As far as how I juggle and how I go back and forth, the thing that I like to do is immerse myself in whatever kind of world I'm going to inhabit. So if I'm going to be writing a horror piece, I might go to – I like to work at Barnes & Noble because it takes me out of the house, it gets me out of my comfort zone, and it gets me kind of moving. So I'll go to Barnes & Noble, and I will grab four or five horror novels that I've never read before, and maybe a couple that I have read before, just so I know I've got something good to catch me as a net if the other ones stink. But I'll sit there and I'll just read them for a little while and kind of get myself into that groove. It is hard to juggle. It is hard to move back and forth. My biggest problem when I'm moving back and forth is I tend to forget what my main character's name is. So I could be writing in a book about John and Jill and end up calling Jill Sarah the whole time because the screenplay I was working on yesterday has Sarah as a main character. But that's what post-writing and editing is for, and you do that just through practice. I mean, it's very much a practiced, learned skill, and there's no other way to do it than through hard work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
Good question, Regina.
I don't know why she was nervous about that question. It was great.
Well, let's move on to the seventh point. I think that's the one we're on.
Nope, we're on number eight.
Are we? You're right. We did do eight. A seven. Okay, eight. What's
okay.
Eight
is another one with a good story. Eight is to be interesting and interested. And this goes back to what I was talking just a minute ago about. You want to look at people as more than just potential paychecks. They are real people, and they have real interests and real desires. And if you look at things that way, it can pay off in fun ways. It was about a year or so ago. I went to a meeting. I got a phone call from a friend who said, we're interested in talking to you about a screenplay. And I went, great, that's good news. So I went into the production company, and my friend, who I'm going to call Johnny again because I'm lazy, Johnny says, I want to introduce you to my boss, Keith. So, and I'm changing all the names to protect the wicked. So Keith walks in.
And your contract.
Yeah, exactly. Keith walks in, and I was wearing, I'm a martial artist, and I was wearing a jacket that said Black Belt Club on it. And Keith goes, what does that mean? And I said, well, it means I'm a black belt. I thought that was fairly apparent, but, you know, I'll point it out to you. Yeah, it means I'm a black belt. And he gives me this five-minute lecture about how karate is voodoo. And so after he does this, I sit there and I go, well, I, you know, respectfully disagree. And he gives me another five-minute lecture about how karate is voodoo. So I asked as good-naturedly as I could if he wanted a demonstration. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, how would you start a fight? And he said, well, I'd grab you like this and I'd do this. And I said, well, why don't you go ahead and try that? So he grabs me, and I put him very good-naturedly and kindly face down on the conference table. And then I let him up. Now, this is not to say my advice is to go and assault the people who might pay your checks, but after I let him up, and again, it was all very good-natured. I wasn't being a jerk and saying, you have insulted my honor, and now I must put you on the ground to prove my superiority. It was just, hey, it was a moment for me to show him that karate is really cool stuff. And so I did it with that attitude. I let him up, and he went into a two-hour discussion with me about a karate. We didn't say a word about the screenplay until the very end, and he goes, oh, I had a question about the end. Does this happen at the end? And I said, yeah. And he goes, that's what I thought happened. Okay. And he walked out, and that was the entirety of our discussion. Well, the very next day, I got a phone call from Johnny, and Johnny was hysterical during this process, by the way, because it's his boss I'm assaulting, so his eyes were huge. You know, I'm sure he was half going, oh, my gosh, he's killing my boss, and half of him was going, this is awesome, he's killing my boss. But anyways, the next day, Johnny calls and says, we want to pick up the script. And I know that I had passed a test with Keith. Because given the choice, there's lots and lots of people out there. There are lots and lots and lots and lots of people out there who have good, solid pieces of work that they're willing to show and sell to people. And so there will come a time probably where somebody has a limited amount of money to invest in a project, and they're looking at you and another person. And they're going to go with the person who's more interested and more interesting. You know, so by coming in there and being willing to do some silly karate stuff with this guy, I was showing myself to be somebody that, you know, they could go and hang out with, or that they could just get along with, so that they wouldn't have a hellacious time while we were doing the rewrites. This is just a reality of our world today. Because of the pervasive nature of today's media, a writer has to be prepared to be more than just a wordsmith. He has to be a friend, an intimate, someone that others can feel connected to and interested in. And this is especially true where you're talking about publishing with a major publishing house. There are tremendous sums of money at stake with that, and they are going to want somebody who can get out there and shill their own work, somebody who's a good spokesperson for themselves, somebody who gets out there and goes, hey, I'm an interesting guy. Wouldn't you like to read my work? And so it really, really pays if you can develop in yourself a sense of interest in other people to find out what they like and what they want to talk about, and an ability to be interesting yourself, because nobody wants to work with or pay for a boring piece of skin. You're a writer, and if you want to be a successful one, the reality is you have to be a personality.
And you know, going back to, and I don't want to pick on Regina, she can't hear me, she can't talk back anyway, some people are very shy, some people just don't like talking in public, not everybody's a lawyer, but what advice do you have for people who are a little more withdrawn, who, you know,
I've lost you, Robin. I lost you there for a second. Can you repeat your question?
Sorry, you told me I was an invalid option again. But for the people that are scared to get up in front of big groups, I know a best-selling author, Robin Carr, who does Carr Chat every regularly at her local library where she interviews other authors. And she is, she's not a natural, that's not what really cranks her up. She actually gets very scared before everyone, gets very nervous, but she powers through it. But do you have any tips for our listeners of how they can turn what might be a hesitant and taciturn personality into something that's more marketable?
Sure. Well, the first thing that I want to point out is you might not like me a whole lot, but I've managed to survive this whole discussion here, and I've managed to do it without too much stuttering or fainting. And the reality is, by nature, I am an extremely shy, introverted human being. After I have to have small talk with people, I have to go change my shirt because I've sweated so much. It's just not something that I'm a natural person at doing. So if you're not a natural, you can listen to this podcast and go, hey, he did it, I can do it. So that's just a reality check. Anybody can do it. For people who are really shy, really introverted, what I did is I literally realized when I was 11 or 12 years old that I had no friends, that girls were never going to want to talk to me, and I went to the nicest, chummiest person I knew, which was my mom, and I said, Mom, how do I make friends? And she kind of gave me some vague answers, and I pinned her down, and I said, Mom, give me some steps to making friends. And so she literally gave me 10 things that I could do to make friends with people. And I don't remember them all at this point. I mean, it was 30 years ago. No, not 30. I'm not that old. It was some years ago. But she gave me these steps, and that's tremendously helpful. I would recommend anybody who's got a shyness problem to read How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. It's a wonderful piece of work, and what I would suggest you do is read the whole thing with a highlighter, highlight it whenever he says to do something, and then pick two or three of those things that sound good and start doing them consciously. One of the things that he suggests is calling people by name, and so if you're a shy person, don't say, okay, my goal is to speak at Madison Square Garden because you're going to die of a heart attack, but say, my goal is that the next three strangers I meet, I will learn their names and call them by name. And just take these gradual baby steps, and it will become more and more second nature. If you're a shy, unassuming, introverted person like I am, I'm going to tell you, it will never become your nature. You're never going to change that shy, unassuming heart of yourself. But it can become second nature so easy that you do it without thinking, to be more of an extrovert and to be able to talk to people. So that's my advice there, is start small, do measurable, concrete things, and gradually work your way up, and always know that you can do it. I mean, just don't let anybody say you're too shy, because that's just somebody who's jealous of how fast you're moving.
Okay, very cool. Well, let's move on to the ninth thing. What's the ninth tip?
All right, the ninth tip is, if you're going to embark on a journey in this world we call writing, you must be prepared to be a part of a big game hunt, and you are not the hunter. This is one of the few that is a downer. I mean, most of these 10 steps are, hey, I think they're very affirming, but this one just sucks, and there's no other face to put on it. If you want to be a writer, you are stating that you are a public personality, and you're painting a bullseye on your forehead. I wrote a book a couple of months back, and it got picked up for publication by a small press, and it went up on Amazon, and all of a sudden, these vitriolic, nasty reviews started popping up on everything that I had written. And they were all written by the same person, and they were all clearly written from the point of view of somebody who hadn't read the story. Look, if you hate my work, you're entitled to hate it. Everybody is different. But this person hadn't even read the things that he or she was complaining about. And it became very apparent that I had somehow irked whoever this was. I still don't know the person that was really doing it, because they were hiding behind an assassin's mask of anonymity. And that was really distressing. But that, unfortunately, is the reality. If you want to work, you're going to have to get used to a certain amount of negativity that goes along with working as a writer. If you're going to be a successful writer, you are holding yourself up in a spotlight and saying, hey, I am really good at this. And that, of course, invites people to look back at you and go, hey, you suck at this. And that's really hard to take. So you have to, along with becoming outgoing, you have to also develop a certain amount of thick-skinnedness. You have to be able to let those nasty barbs and taunts bounce off of you, because if you can't, if you take them and internalize them, they will destroy you. So just as you're going in, as you're starting your career as a writer, recognize this is going to have some nasty parts to it. And I hate to say that, because I wish it was all pixies and fairy dust, but the fact is there are some nasty people out there who will always be jealous of anybody who's trying to live their dream.
And regarding that, a lot of writers have families. Do you take any steps yourself to protect your family and keep them away from the big game hunt?
I absolutely do. I never mention them. I mean, I talk about my family. I love my family, but you will never catch me calling my family by name. My wife is on Facebook, and that's fine, but I've told her she's not allowed. My wife could beat the tar out of me, so I can't tell her anything. But I have asked her very nicely to not put any of the kids' pictures up, because I don't want them subjected to any of the abuse that I've been subjected to as I've tried to become a writer. And look, nobody's tried to tar and feather me or anything like that, but it is distressing when somebody calls you a nasty name for no other reason than because they've disagreed with some stance you've taken in a book, or one of your characters has taken, which you don't even agree with, or something like that. It's a stinky, awful part of writing, but unfortunately it's a reality, especially in today's world where more and more people think because they have an opinion and are able to voice it from an anonymous soapbox, they must be entitled to be as nasty and horrifying as possible.
How, if at all, should we respond to that sort of negativity?
As much as possible, don't. Every time that you give a response to somebody, you are enabling them to further act. By your very act of responding, you are saying, hey, you're getting to me. Far better to just ignore them. I recently read a book by a very famous security expert who consults for the Secret Service on presidential security and things like that. I mean, he's the top of the game. And he was talking about if you're getting a person who's calling you constantly, who's threatening you, who's doing things like that, he said, don't change your phone number, because guess what? That just tells them they're getting to you and they're going to find the new phone number. He said, just give everybody else a new phone number. Get a new number, keep the old one active, and get everybody else in your life that you care about, give them the new number. And pretty soon, the only person calling that old number will be the person that you don't care about. You'll never have to pick up that phone again. And after a while, they'll stop. So the best response, I mean, unless you're in physical danger of some kind, or unless you are being smeared in a way that you just can't tolerate, is to ignore it. Now, with this person who is taking pot shots at me, they actually tried to up the ante by contacting Amazon and threatening to get the positive reviews on my work pulled. And what ended up happening is Amazon contacted me, and I let them know this person hasn't read anything. If you look at the reviews, it's clear. And all of their reviews got pulled. So I didn't do anything. I just ignored it as long as I could. And when somebody asked me my opinion, I gave it, and it worked out fine. You just have to be long-suffering and let evil people fall into their own traps.
Cool. I like that. So what's the last one, number 10?
Okay, last one is possibly the most important one. You cannot fail at this job if you don't give up. I sold my first story at the age of 15. I am older than 15 now. Between my first sale and my second sale, I accumulated well over 1,000 pages of rejections, and that's not counting the hundreds and hundreds of electronic rejections. None of them were nasty. Contrary to myth, I have never gotten a rejection letter that said, you suck, give up your job, or don't ever give up your day job. A few of them were a bit brusque, but they all boiled down to the same thing, which was no thanks. Now, gratefully, my high school dating life had prepared me for rejection, so I was good there, but it still was tough after adding up 1,000 writing rejections, it got a little difficult, especially because in between the rejections, I did get certain offers that I rejected because I didn't think they were right for me. Either the money was wrong or the terms were bad, or I just got a bad feeling from the person offering it. But ultimately, I endured a 2-decade-long dry spell, and I kept on writing. If you look at our arguably most influential and famous president, is George Washington, and if it isn't him, it's Abraham Lincoln. If you read up on Abraham Lincoln, the guy's life was one long series of failures, and the only reason he got elected as a president was because the South was a massive chaos. There were secession talks. There were all these issues that were fragmenting the parties. And in his own party, there were four other guys who were radically more qualified in the public opinion, radically more qualified for the job of president than Abraham Lincoln was. And what he did was send out his envoys and say, make sure I am everybody's second choice. Because he knew if he was everybody's second choice, he would win in the end. And writing is a lot like that. You have to be willing to put yourself out there, and you have to keep on going even though you're not popular, even though you're getting rejected. You have got to keep writing. Writers write. Always, always remember that a writer is someone who writes. There is no other criteria. There is no other requirement. A person who writes is a writer. A writer who persists is a person who is preparing for success, and those who prepare for success are those who most often find themselves ready for it when it comes.
Is there, I'm sure all of us have read the works of fledgling writers who seem a little delusional. It's like,
You're an invalid response again.
To those that perhaps are very, very low down the down the writing skill mountain, is there hope for them too?
Yes, there's hope for everybody. Look, you can become. When I started out, I couldn't write a word, just like everybody, because I was a baby and I had to learn how to write. And my parents had to teach me how to read, and it's an ongoing process. And if you read some of my stuff that I write now, it stinks, because not everything that I write is going to be golden. No matter who you are, you can get better. I think that just about everybody, there may be some people who have real clinical mental deficiencies or difficulties that challenge them, but even they can become better, and most of us can become professional quality. I truly believe that. It takes work. It takes a lot of effort, and it takes a real focus and a real dedication to the task, but people can do it. No matter who you are, if you're willing to put in the time, just remember, the only way you are 100% guaranteed of failing is if you give up.
Cool. Do you have any advice as far as trying to focus ourselves into a particular genre or a particular kind of writing, how to find what's going to give us, personally, the greatest chance of success?
Well, I personally think that you write what you like. I will never be a romance writer, and that's not because I think they are evil or write drivel or anything like that. It's just because I myself am not attracted to that genre. I also believe that I personally have the greatest romance in my own personal life with my wife, and writing it seems secondary after I'm living it all the time. So it's just not something that drives me. I have always clung to a home base of scary things. And I really enjoy that. I also really enjoy young adult fiction. I like YA fantasies. I am proud to say that I am friends with Brandon Mull, who wrote the fabulous Fablehaven series. I'm friends with James Dashner, who's written the Maze Runner trilogy. I love these guys. They are great writers, and I think that stuff is fun. So when my wife told me, point blank, you better write something that I can read to the kids or I'll divorce you, I was able to write something in the young adult fair because I enjoy that stuff too. So you can definitely cross genres, you can do different things, but it's very hard to get excited about something that you're not enjoying reading, much less writing. It's much more hard to create than it is to involve yourself in the already created worlds of somebody else. So if you look at a genre and you think, gosh, I have legitimately given that genre a chance, I've read some of it, enough of it to have a good idea what the tropes and rules of the genre are, and I just don't like it, stay away from it. Go find what you do like to read and write that.
Well, I'm going to ask you for any last thoughts, but first I'm going to give everyone a chance to ask any final questions. Again, push 5-star if you have any questions. And I'm going to give you a chance to press that while we ask Michael Brent if you've got anything that you haven't told us yet that you think we need to know.
The one thing that I would say is that this is, again, this is a tremendous opportunity. If you feel a call or an urge to write, do it. It's a wonderful, wonderful, powerful way to spend your time. You can do it for the entirety of your life as long as you have, you know, either a hand to write with or somebody willing to take dictation. You can do it, and it is a great thing, and it's a noble thing. It can truly be an ennobling adventure. And so if you feel like you want to do it, then please do it. The world could use more writers, and the only way we will get more good writers is if more people take the time to make themselves good.
Very cool. I do have a couple questions. Jenny
Great.
From Ohio. Jenny, go ahead.
Hi, Jenny from Ohio.
Hi, I just have enjoyed this so much. I'm typing notes by the page here. I have a question. Since what my passion is writing whimsical, I guess you would call it fantasy, children's picture books. So to be successful, I need to find an artist.
Right.
Because how do you do that? How do you find someone who can actually get at your vision and create these whimsical, funny people, characters that you're seeing, that you want? How do you do that?
Well, there are any number of ways. One way is you can go to the bookstore and start pulling books off the shelf and look for the names of the artists. Google them. The internet is so great. You can find almost anybody if you really want to. And look up the people whose art you like. Now, you might not be able to get the person who did the cover for Fablehaven to do your book because he's probably very busy doing major releases. Incidentally, a friend of mine, speaking of the cover of Fablehaven, a friend of mine wrote a book called Janitors that's coming out in a couple of months. And it's Taylor Whiteside. It's got the same artist as the Fablehaven people, and the cover is fabulous. You got to check it out. Anyways, so you can look. That was a little plug for a friend. You can look up artists that you like. You can go to community colleges. Teachers are great resources for almost anything because teachers love to talk about stuff that they know about. So if you find out when the art classes are in your community college or in your local university and get on campus and go after class and say, hey, I'm an author. I wonder if you have any really good artists who draw fairies or who draw Hufflepuffs or whatever it is that you're talking about. Because I'm writing a book and I would love to collaborate with somebody. You might be surprised at the number of responses you get. But in any event, no matter which avenue you pursue, keep your eyes open. That's the real secret to finding anybody to collaborate with, because the more you maintain an awareness of what you're looking for, the more you'll see it. It's sort of like when you buy your first car and it's a Toyota Celica. You look out and you realize that every single car on the road is a Toyota Celica. And it's not because suddenly they have multiplied and become more voluminous than they were before. It's just because you're aware of them.
Oh, okay. But you wouldn't necessarily have to pay this person to collaborate with you.
It depends. If you're going to go with a high-powered professional, again, if you're going with the guy who did the Fablehaven cover, yeah, you're going to pay. If you're going to look for an art student who might be willing to take a back-end deal or do it for credit, they might not need any payment. Each artist is different. Each artist will have their realm of what's acceptable to them, and it's going to depend on their level of experience and what their next goal is. But you can certainly look around for non-paying options
or just a collaboration. If it should get published, they would obviously get paid.
Yeah, or you know, you go to church, ask your friends at church, go, hey, does anybody know an artist? There might be a great artist who's sitting next to you or at your bridge club or at the YMCA or where you work out. I mean, don't be afraid to ask everybody you know, hey, do you know any good artists? Because, again, if you can make the personal connection, that's always the best way.
Great. Thank you. That's a great idea.
You're welcome.
Great question. Let's go on to phone number ending 5977. Tell us your name, then tell us your question.
Okay, great. Thanks. Michael Brent, thank you very much. I consider this time well spent.
Oh, good.
So
I'm
thanks
so
for
glad.
Taking the time.
What's your name?
Jordan Ricks.
Cool. Hi, Jordan. Thank you.
Hi. Yeah. Hey, I'm just wondering, I'm trying to do some genre blending, and I'm wondering if you have any warnings against that?
Here's the I actually like genre blending. Oh, I heard a click. Are we still on?
We're good.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just get nervous, like I'm all alone talking to myself. I like genre blending because, for me personally, publishing my e-books, it allows me to put them on various lists, and it increases the chances that somebody on one of those lists will go, hey, I like occult books. Hey, I like spiritual books. Hey, I like paranormal romances. Hey, I like vampires. Hey, I like shotgun-wielding whales, you know, whatever it is. That being said, it is a real major stumbling block for a lot of agents and a lot of publishers simply because they don't know where to put your books on the shelf. And if they can't niche you somewhere, it's going to be harder to market you. When I was at LTUE over the last couple weeks, James Dashner, who wrote the Maze Runner trilogy, was sitting on a panel about dystopian worlds. And his first comment was something like, I don't even know what that is. My books aren't dystopian. They're post-apocalyptic. But they get called dystopian because there's no post-apocalyptic section in the young adult section of Barnes & Noble. So if you're going to genre bend, you have to be aware that there are some risks to it, that people are going to have a hard time kind of putting you in a comfy little pocket that they can grab onto easily. And that was a real impediment for Dean Koontz in his early years as a writer. He had to become established as a thriller writer before he could really start to mix and match the way he does now. And I think he's wonderful at it, but there are very few people, if you look at the market, most people are in a specific genre, and that's because it makes them easier to market.
Right. Well, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Jordan. We are going to go ahead and wrap it up. Thank you so much, everyone, for calling. We just to have more information or to purchase Michael Brent's books, do visit his website at www.michaelbrentcallings.com. His books, of course, are a lot of them are available on ebook, which means you can download them immediately, right, Michael Brent?
Absolutely. I hope you do.
So it's very cool. Also, a recording of this call will be made available to members of Farland's Writers Groups as well as on our blog, www.authorsadvisory.blogspot.com. Michael Brent, are you going to make it available on your website as well?
I probably will in the next couple of days.
Okay, I'll get that to you then. Our next call is going to be on March 23rd. I am going to be interviewing Dan Wells, who wrote I Am Not a Serial Killer, a book everyone needs.
He's a cool guy, too.
Also one of the three that does writing excuses, so he's very experienced in talking to people. He let me pick his topic, finally. I cornered him at LTUE, and he's going to be discussing monsters, sociopaths, and other sympathetic characters, which I think is a perfect topic for him. But there may be some spoilers for I Am Not a Serial Killer, so make sure you read that one before you tune into the call. But thank you so much, Michael Brent, for coming and sharing with us.
We lost you again, but I'll say it's been my pleasure.
It must have been an invalid option again.
What a perfect time for it. Hey, can I say one more thing real quick?
Do.
One last thing, especially since mostly we're talking to authors here, I would encourage you, if you read a book that you like, especially if it's one of mine, go ahead and post a review of it on Amazon or wherever you can post a review, because those little words of kindness really get us authors through the lonely, hot, horrible days of nobody liking our work, and you know what it's like to be a writer. So I every single book that I read, I try and post a review somewhere about it, or plug it, or something. And I would hope that more people would do that, because truly, you will see your own work improve as you try and encourage others in theirs.
Very good advice. I think we should all start doing that more. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Michael Brent. Thank you so much for coming.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Robin. I really appreciate it and had a great time.
Hey, I knew it would be fun. We'll see you guys all next time.
Take care.